This is Scott King, Science and Energy Reporter with the Sierra Nevada Ally. A new battleground is forming in the state of Nevada, where an influx of federal funding and state-level tax incentives are seeking to kickstart a critical mineral economy necessary to support the renewable energy transition. But while critical minerals provide foundational components to all of our electronic devices, from everyday technologies like cell phones and laptops, to renewable energy technologies like wind turbines and electric vehicle batteries, extracting them from the ground does not come without its costs. Perhaps no better example of this complex challenge exists than with two proposed lithium mines in Nevada. At Rhyolite Ridge, an endangered flower could go extinct if a lithium mine becomes operational. But if climate change continues unchecked without a renewable energy transition, the flower might go extinct anyway. At Thacker Pass, a lithium mine could affect rural and indigenous communities alike. Ranchers and farmers may see their groundwater depleted or contaminated, and a tribe may see their sacred lands destroyed, which begs the question of who bears the true cost of ensuring our economic, energy, and national security with critical minerals. Meanwhile, an outdated mining law subsidizes mining operations on federal lands without requiring royalties to be paid to taxpayers, both padding corporate profits and drawing a striking contrast with the oil and gas industries that have powered our economy for decades. With me today is Ernest Scheider, who just released The War Below: Lithium, Copper, and the Global Battle to Power Our Lives. He's here to talk about the book and introduce what the critical mineral economy means, not only to the everyday reader, but to the everyday Nevadan. Ernest, thanks for joining me today. Can you describe the book and how the idea for it came about?
Sure thing. I've been chronicling for several years proposed mining projects across the United States and the world that would supply lithium and copper and nickel and cobalt and other critical minerals and metals for the energy transition. But I began to notice that many of these projects faced opposition from folks for completely legitimate reasons, whether it was around indigenous rights reasons or ecological reasons or other reasons. And increasingly, when you have so many no's stack up, it brings up the question, well, where are we going to get these building blocks for these green energy devices? Things that help us fight climate change, like solar panels and wind turbines, but also gadgets that increasingly are used commonplace every single day, like cell phones, laptop batteries, etc. And so the book really is an exploration of the choice that we face if we want this energy transition. Where are the places that we're willing to allow mines? What are the standards by which we want mines to operate? And are there some places too special to mine? And the book looks at the humans that are on all sides of this issue, and it is written for everyone because it's a topic that I firmly believe matters to us all.
You spent a substantial portion of your book covering the Rhyolite Ridge and Thacker Pass projects. Given the prominent role that these projects play in your book, can you describe why you felt it was important to focus on these two tentative projects, and the state of Nevada in particular?
Sure thing. Nevada has a huge mineral resource, not just for gold and silver, but for many, many other critical minerals and metals that are so important for the energy transition. And when I took a look at the Thacker Pass and Rhyolite Ridge projects, I wanted to include them given the sheer size of the deposits that are there, the sheer potential to help really power this energy transition, and also the complexities that are involved in the permitting process for both projects that really help encapsulate this idea of choice. So with Rhyolite Ridge, you've got a story of a very large lithium deposit, one of the largest in the country, and it's commingled with boron, which is used to make soaps. And anytime you have two materials that you can develop at once, that's great for investors and for companies because you basically have two revenue streams. So you can see the potential right there. But the problem is that this deposit, which is about 200 miles north of Las Vegas, it lies underneath this habitat for a rare flower found nowhere else on the planet. And this is known as Team's buckwheat. It's a beautiful little flower. It's about 6 inches or so tall, and it blooms between May and June. And it has these beautiful red seeds that help propagate the next generation. But the question and the tension becomes right away, can the mine and the flower coexist? Can you develop an open pit mine next to where this rare flower found nowhere else on the planet goes? And if not, does one matter more than the other? What are the choices we're willing to make here? If we let this flower basically go under because of the mines development, what does that say about our approach as humans to biodiversity? If we did nothing and we just let climate change continue, would not the flower go extinct due to climate change? So there's a lot of really interesting questions that I want the audience to juggle with here. Thacker Pass, which is on the Nevada-Oregon border, so farther north than Rhyolite Ridge, is actually the largest deposit of lithium in the entire North American continent. It's extremely, extremely big. And so you can see why it's been such a big prize for such a long time. The company has run into some opposition from the local Native American tribes, as well as some conservationists and environmental groups that take a pretty stark approach to industrialization. They actually advocate for a deindustrialization. And they partnered for a time with the Native American groups in the region to fight this project, including in court, where they filed several lawsuits. And so I thought it was extremely important, especially given the prolific size of this deposit, as well as the multi-stakeholder opposition to it, to better understand the people and the issues at play there. And so I really thought that those two helped bring to the reader this idea of choice that I think is so crucial to the War Below's key narrative and helping people understand it better. And Nevada plays a starring role in that narrative.
Then, to take it a step further, there's been a big push in the state of Nevada to close the quote-unquote lithium loop, or essentially round out the lithium economy with not only mining of the mineral, but also the processing, refining, and recycling of it as well. So can you elaborate why it's important to look at the broader economic implications beyond just mining for closing the lithium loop and the rest of the critical mineral economy?
In The War Below, I have a chapter looking at recycling, and there's two recycling companies in particular that I profile. One is Li-Cycle, which is headquartered in Toronto, and another will be known to folks in Nevada. It's J.B. Straubel's Redwood, which is in the Reno area. And both companies take different approaches to how they look at recycling from a strategic perspective, but they each want to obviously take end-of-life batteries and repurpose them for use in new batteries down the line. And it's really important to get to recycle in order to get to the idea of what's known as a circular economy. And this is the concept that the old cell phones or EV batteries or old wires or whatnot that are out there can be turned in, recycled, and that the metals inside can be reused. Because unlike oil and natural gas, which after it's used for combustion is burned off, these metals do not lose their ability to be used in batteries once they've been sitting in a battery for, say, 10 or 20 years. You know, lithium does not lose its ability to hold a charge just because it's been in a Tesla for a few years. And so if you can recycle those, it makes it very appealing in order to reduce your use of mines down the road. But when we're actually get to that tipping point, known as circular economy, I think is anyone's guess. Some say 2040, some say 2050. You know, it could be beyond that. We just don't know. What we do know is that we're going to need mines for the foreseeable future. And then at some point, we'll start to decrease our need to basically dig a hole in the ground. And we'll have to then focus a lot more on recycling. You've got some companies right now that are, and some mining companies that are very interested in this. Albemarle, for instance, world's largest lithium producer. It actually operates a facility in Nevada right now that produces lithium at Silver Peak. It has started to plan out a lithium refinery project in South Carolina that will include as part of its plans a recycling component. And that is, you know, on the drawing board for a few years down the road, but it just shows that the lithium industry is beginning to think about this potential of recycling and getting to a closed loop concept.
Lithium tends to garner most of the attention when people think of critical minerals. But in this book, you made a noted effort to talk about other critical minerals such as copper and rare earths and how they support the whole renewable energy industry. Likewise, we've seen attention in Nevada drawn to the potential for nickel, cobalt, and copper mining opportunities, even vanadium. So why is it important to look at the broader range of critical minerals beyond just lithium in order to support the transition?
Well, lithium, of course, is one of the key components of the energy transition, specifically because of lithium-ion batteries. I mean, lithium, of course, is in the name. And so that's why I thought it was so important to focus on that. Copper as well. Copper is in so much wiring. It's in many motors. It is really the anchor for a lot of this work. But, you know, when we think of the petroleum-based economy that really defines the 20th century, I think people sort of understand roughly how petroleum is taken out of the ground, and that you put petroleum in a refinery and then you get crude oil or you get gasoline or diesel or other end products out of there. With critical minerals, the production process is vastly diverse. You know, how you produce lithium is much different than how you produce nickel. But a lot of batteries require both. And a lot of batteries also need other minor metals. Antimony helps reduce the potential for a fire in a battery. And that's just a very minor metal right there. And so there's a whole range beyond that that also have different uses. Certain metals are used to harden steel and make it more conducive for things in high strength applications. And so there's a whole host of critical mineral metals out there that are not just what I would call the big five. And those five are lithium, copper, cobalt, nickel, and rare earths. And there's a whole lot of other ones out there. So this, unlike the oil and gas powered economy, this is not just about one grouping of products. This is about a whole grouping of products. And we're going to need all of them if we want an energy transition.
Our reporting at the Sierra Nevada Ally has been exploring the trade-offs around who really benefits from these mining projects and whether they come at the expense of underserved communities, such as rural and indigenous communities. What are your thoughts on how we can ensure communities most directly affected by these mines, those in predominantly rural areas, also see the benefits?
My main guiding light here in writing the book was really bringing these complex situations to people and to readers and to have them grapple with this idea of choice. And central to that question is, how do we want people that live on the front lines of these extractive projects to live with them? And how much voice should they have as part of that? And we're not really having that discussion right now. And indecision is, in a way, a choice. So if we're not going to be thinking through how indigenous communities and how other frontline communities are affected by mines and or should have a voice in mines, then we have to be comfortable with, you know, perhaps a mine not being developed there or going forward and not giving full respect to these issues. And so what I'm hoping with the book is that people really think through, okay, if this mine affects an indigenous holy site or indigenous lands, you know, what are the proper standards by which we should be thinking through free, prior, and informed consent? How should federal regulators be working with indigenous groups to ensure that their views are respected and other people that might have concerns about an extractive project based on ESG issues or environmental, social, and governance issues? So these are things that we as voters, we as Americans have to be thinking through. We're not thinking through them right now. And I really hope the book sparks a conversation because obviously these critical minerals are important, but how we get them is just as important.
Can you share your perspective on the role critical minerals play in three major security concerns for the United States? How can critical minerals ensure that the United States has energy security, economic security, and national security now and into the future?
Look back 4 years. You know, it was 4 years ago this month that the coronavirus pandemic really was growing fast. And all of a sudden, a lot of folks, especially the United States, realized that the country did not make any masks, that most basic piece of necessary medical equipment that we all used and was ubiquitous during the high point of the pandemic. And so I think that sort of surprised a lot of people, and it reinforced this idea of this importance of supply chains, which is sort of a wonky, sleepy topic, but a crucial topic. You know, where we get our things matter. And so as we start the, I would call it maybe the first few innings of the energy transition, just magnify that issue with masks onto all the other building blocks, all the other products. And you can start to see that, like, where we get the building blocks for all of these products that we're using every single day matters. You know, the wiring that we're talking to, the wiring that we're being used to talk through right now is a copper wire. You know, the electronics and the other gadgets that we're using are filled with lithium and cobalt and nickel. And where we get them matters. And whoever controls copper and lithium and cobalt and nickel will control the 21st century economy. And so it behooves countries around the world to be thinking about, okay, where are we going to get these supplies? I mean, maybe the concept of energy independence is not necessarily completely achievable, but what I do explore in the book is the idea that if we want these transition perks really to happen or the benefits of this transition, then we've got to be thinking about, do we want more production domestically or even on the continent? And what does that look like? And I think the Inflation Reduction Act tries to take a step forward on that area, but you can't have the benefits of the Inflation Reduction Act unless you have more mining. There's just no way around that. And so when we think about sort of
countries that have large supplies of these or refine large supplies of these critical minerals, some of them are willing to use them as economic weapons. China has already signaled that it's willing to use its prowess in the space as an economic weapon. And so some of those materials that China processes are used in weapons and other key infrastructure used by the Pentagon. And so that's another thing, too, that gets into national security. And so energy security, national security, all types of U.S. And regional security do have to do with critical minerals. And this is a topic that I think is another thing that we have to be thinking about. It gets back to this idea of choice that I really hope folks think through when they read The War Below.
That was Ernest Scheider, author of The War Below, Lithium, Copper, and the Global Battle to Power Our Lives, a book exploring the complex balance between our need for critical minerals to support a renewable energy economy and combat climate change, while recognizing and acknowledging the valid concerns of those communities truly bearing its costs. Scott King, Sierra Nevada Ally.